Hello, hello. Welcome to One Wild World, a podcast by The Echo. I'm your host, Matthew Juno.
And I'm the editor, Mike Davis.
You know, Mike, in many of our episodes, we've touched on the fact that animals have such a deep history with being portrayed in Hollywood and media, but not all animals are represented equally.
Yeah, that's a good point. What are some examples that you can think of?
Well, with dogs or cats, it seems like for every time they play the villains, like in movies like Cujo or Pet Sematary, they also can play the heroes too, like in Homeward Bound or Puss in Boots. But some animals fall more heavily on one end of that spectrum.
Yeah, I think that's often the case with predators.
That's correct. In light of that, I wanted to discuss how snakes are portrayed in movies. Granted, there are a lot of movies I haven't seen, but with a little research, I had a hard time finding movies where snakes are the good guys. The only example I found was in Kung Fu Panda.
Oh, yeah. Viper in that movie is part of the legendary Furious Five, a force for good in the world. Voiced, of course, by Lucy Liu.
The amazing Lucy Liu. Can't get enough. So there's that one good example. And then you see all the other movies that feature snakes, and it starts getting a little more lopsided. Anaconda, Venom, Snake Island, Rattlers, and Hiss all feature snakes as antagonists.
Snakes do seem to pop up quite a bit. Even in The Jungle Book, the snake Ka tries to eat Mowgli. Also, in Harry Potter, Nagini is Team Voldemort. Like, come on, guys.
And the list keeps growing. It starts to get a bit overwhelming. Mega Snake, Snake Man, Komodo versus Cobra, Mega Python versus Gatoroid, which, a quick little tangent, is a great B movie. And of course, Snakes on a Plane. And you know what, Mike? Enough is enough. I'm tired of these misrepresented snakes on this mother plane.
Whoa. I appreciate the passion, but let's walk it back a little bit.
You're right. I did get a bit heated. I'm sorry. I think with today's guest talking about snakes and other reptiles, I just wanted to show that I care about these critters. But to simmer down, I can always go to my happy place with a little game called
What's That Animal?
Today, I really think I can stump the listeners. Some of the rounds we've played, I've made very easy, but today, I'm presenting a real challenge. So for the first time, here's the sound. I told you that today I'm not going to make it easy. I will say that this animal does live in North America. One more time, here's the sound. Now, remember, the animal I feature here is closely related to the type of animal the guest works with. So keep the sound in mind during the conversation, and I'll reveal the answer at the end of the episode. Our guest today is Håkon Carlton of Carlton Carnivores. He has a master's degree in biological sciences, specializing in taxonomy and conservation, and has a deep passion for all reptiles, and even carnivorous plants too. Let's check out the conversation now. I know on your website it says that you've loved animals for 20 years and that reptiles has been a big part of that. How did your appreciation for reptiles first start?
Well, I can remember quite a ways back, interestingly, when I was like 3 years old or so, we were at a place called Webster Lake in Denver, Colorado, and my dad happened to catch a little plains garter snake, held it up to me, and at that time I was like a lot of people, not really sure what to make of what he was holding, and no, I didn't want to touch it. But fast forward about a year, we were at a place called the Thompson Ponds, and I happened to spot a northern water snake swimming across one of the ponds. And for whatever reason, that just kind of clicked. Like, okay, that thing is cool. I want to know more. I love them. And it just snowballed from there. Got my first pet snake, a snowcorn that we named Frosty, a year later when I was 5 years old. And the rest is history.
I do wonder how many people got into animals or wildlife with the help of garter snakes as their first animal. I know that for me growing up, I remember we were heading to go to the pool and my cousin saw a garter snake kind of slithering across the bridge and he'd went up and caught it. And I was fairly young at the time and I was like, that's some Steve Irwin stuff. I was like, that's so cool. I want to be able to do that. And so it's kind of grown for me as well. So
I find it interesting, like garter snakes, they're a really common animal and a lot of people, that's among the first snake that they'll see. But the snake that I encountered, the water snake that really struck it off here in Colorado, isn't all that common a snake. So kind of a lucky hit that I got to see one of those when I was that young. Although it certainly didn't take long for me to start finding and catching garter snakes, of course, out in the wild. Summer vacations when we would go up to Vail and have a condo up there. Hey, there's wandering garters right outside the building. It's crawling along the wall. I'm going to pick it up and go show my cousins and freak them out.
Shout outs to garter snakes. Can you tell us a little bit about how you started Carlton Carnivores and kind of your goal with it?
When I was young, I always would tell people like, I want to be a herpetologist when I grow up. And then moving along, I started having opportunities to kind of bring animals into the house, or I found eventually the carnivorous plants as well when I was 9 or 10 years old. That fly trap at Lowe's, I killed it within a couple of weeks, but still it got me hooked. So I started realizing I like growing these things. I like handling these things. I like showing them to other people and I like going out places and finding them. So I want to do something that kind of puts all those together, especially as I grew up, went through high school, went into college, kind of started realizing it's important and it's very interesting. I have perhaps slightly too ADHD a brain to really focus on being in research, like in a lab somewhere. So I work better having a fluid environment, being able to go out and see things in the wild, mess with stuff at home, and then use all these different parts and pieces, put them together and bring out all sorts of different means for educating people so they have personal interactions and experiences with them, as that helps get other people interested and wanting to care about them as well. So had a general idea. I want to be in this field, but the exact way I wanted to interact with that field has evolved over time.
Yeah, I think it's pretty important to kind of blaze your own trail and find your own niche for how you can best incorporate like what you're passionate about, what your skills are, how you can bring those two together. Real quickly, I want to head back just a little bit. You threw out the word herpetologist. I'm hoping for our listeners, you can kind of break down what is a herpetologist? What's the study of herpetology?
Herpetology, the base word is from Greek herpeton, which means crawling thing. And so broadly, it's the study of basically any reptile or amphibian on the planet. So salamanders and frogs and amphisbenids and lizards and snakes and crocodiles and turtles and all that. Herpetologists, like a professional, they will be the people who go out and they will study snakes in the natural environment. They will piece together like evolutionary histories, what species are actually out there, whether or not the animals that we are looking at today are actually what we think they are. Like there's a mess with the rat snakes in North America right now that they're trying to figure out what snakes are actually where, especially as genetics come in, we get a clear picture. You have people who study feeding behaviors, venom interactions with predator and prey when it comes to things like rattlesnakes and cobras and such. Anything that goes along with the biology. You also have the pet care herpetologists who study the best ways to take care of the animals too. I love all animals, so I will bring in whatever I find wherever I'm at into my videos and stuff, but my specialties in particular is what one might call ophidiology, the study of snakes, because that's my favorite of the group.
You and I met at Wildfest, which was an event in Fort Collins. And when I walked over to your table, there were all of these people gathered around. You were giving a talk about snakes and you had a couple different species of snakes that were out. I think people either really love snakes or they fear them. And so I'm curious as to how do you break down that barrier and help people either appreciate or respect snakes?
Usually it starts with exposure. Most of the fear that people have is something that is learned culturally. especially like in a group like that at Wildfest, you'll notice the kids are all right up at the table and, oh, I want to touch it. I want to hold it. Can I see it? And the adults are in the back like, keep it at a distance. So it's learned. The kids, they're interested. They're curious. They will interact with it. But once they see the parents doing otherwise, they start to pick up those same behaviors and fear the snakes. So getting people at a young age is kind of important. You expose them to the realities of snakes. The fact that they come in a huge number of colors and shapes and sizes. So there's diversity. They're beautiful. They're interesting. Most of the animals that I had there are very docile animals. They're used to people. So I can show them most snakes. They're not scary. They're not dangerous. They're not going to bite unless you do something stupid to provoke them to do so. So they're not an animal that you have to worry about. Like even if you come across one in the wild, just take two steps back and you're out of range from even most of the venomous snakes. So you can interact with these animals without ever having to fear them at all.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really important to reach people when they're young and those values, especially with insects too, it goes that same way. And that's something I try to do with the Echo is show you can have a respect for an animal and an understanding. And that looks a lot different than a fear of them. Like I respect snakes and I know if I see one out in the wild on a trail and if it's a non-venomous species, I might try to guide it off trail just to make sure that it doesn't have any interactions with people. I've also seen rattlesnakes out in nature and known to kind of just give it its space and it's not going to purposely come over here and just attack me out of the blue, but trying to make sure that people know enough about animals that they have an appreciation and an understanding and then that respect component with snakes and reptiles. Are there any misconceptions that you want to break down about snakes right now?
There could be so many that we could go over, honestly. One of the biggest ones is, oh my God, the snakes will chase you. There's that massive myth about cottonmouths in the Southeast being snakes that will chase after people and they're really aggressive and so on. When in reality, that particular species might well be the most docile and inoffensive of the venomous snakes that we have in the U.S. We have video evidence of people who will literally take their boot and stick it in the cottonmouth's open mouth, and they still can't get the thing to actually bite them because it's the last thing that the snake wants to do. Venomous snakes, they have that venom specifically to try and capture prey. It's a means for them to be able to feed themselves, and that's what it evolved as. That's what it's for. Using it as a defense is kind of a secondary, very last-ditch effort, because if they use it on something that they can't eat, then it takes a while for them to build that reserve back up, and they might miss their next and perhaps last chance at getting food. It's a big risk to them to actually use venom on a person or a wolf or a fox or whatever, so they will try and jump through hoops to get any other tactic to work to get out of that situation so that they don't have to use venom. We like to say snakes are cowards first, actors second, warriors dead last. They will hide, they will run if they have the chance first. If that doesn't work, they're going to put on some sort of show to get you to leave them alone. So the rattlesnakes that most people are familiar with, they'll stand up in the S position, they'll rattle their tail loud and noisy saying, I am here, I am possibly dangerous to you, please take a step back. And that's all you have to do to get out of danger too, because the snake doesn't want anything to do with you. It's not going to come after you. You step back, it may well just stop rattling, turn around and leave. It also comes from sometimes people will see the snake coming in their direction and they think it's chasing them. Half the time it's the snake sees what it thinks is its best escape route is behind you. So maybe there's the thickest brush or there's a nice hole that it sees and you are standing between it and that hole. It will try and dive for that safety oftentimes, and there's video evidence of this too. If you stand dead still, even a rattlesnake will just pass between your legs and disappear into that brush. It will not bother you at all if it doesn't have to.
What role do snakes play in the ecosystem?
Just about every role other than the base herbivores. So there are snakes that prey on insects, arthropods, things like that in my control. Some of those pests and help out there. A lot of them, of course, take on rodents, and snakes are one of the best rodent controls that we have on the planet. They are better than eagles. They are better than cats. They are better than foxes at controlling these things. They help keep down pest populations and therefore also help to regulate diseases that might go around. In some places, snakes also hold the rank of being top tier or apex predators, so they regulate the entire ecosystem under them. Like the indigo snakes down in the southeast that eat other venomous snakes, any other snakes they come across, and they will also eat rodents, small birds, lizards, and things like that. So they control all of those populations, which in turn affects all of the plant populations, the structure of the ecosystem, what kind of microbiome is in the soil, and so on. By being in all of these different tiers, they are extreme regulators of the environment. So you lose them and the entire rest of the ecosystem will break apart. They're extremely important in a number of different ways.
That makes me think of, there's this great article from this naturalist and conservationist, Aldo Leopold, and he talks about thinking like a mountain. And this is specifically with wolves, but the same idea applies here with snakes, that a lot of people historically didn't like wolves. And so they thought, oh, well, let's like get rid of the wolves. And suddenly, if you remove that predator species, well, their prey item will increase in number because there's nothing that's taking that animal. So now you have either more deer running around or more mice and rodents. And then suddenly all of the things that those mice and rodents eat, well, they start to decrease because there's just tons of them. And so it can change the whole landscape without these important predator species.
Mm-hmm.
I know you also mentioned early on that you also sell carnivorous plants as part of Carlton Carnivores. How did that start and what interests you about carnivorous plants?
Yeah, so that started off, like a lot of people, I happened to see something, a fly trap in like a Lowe's sales store, and we picked one up. And I've always been interested in anything that's unusual, out of the norm. So plants with colorful or strangely shaped leaves and so on. So I wanted to pick one up and see what I could do with it. It died within a couple of weeks because the instructions that they give you on that little container are almost always dead wrong. But I was still hooked at that point, like, okay, I failed there, but I'm sure I can get it right the next time. So we found this little seed starting kit at actually a Barnes & Noble bookstore of all places. There was this thing called Carnivorous Creations, and my parents were convinced, okay, we'll get this for him and it'll fail and he'll lose interest at that point. It didn't fail because I followed the instructions correctly, and it was probably a just recently put together kit, so all the seeds were still good. And so I started growing those in the living room, and then I found out, oh, there are other shops that are online that I can find different kinds at. And so I started buying from those places, and then I started realizing there's communities built around this. There's the International Carnivorous Plant Society. I can become a part of that and find other members and discover all these different species, and then started finding books and pulling in all sorts of information. And I'd say I really like them because, one, again, they're odd and they're kind of underappreciated by the general public. A lot of people don't really know about them, so they're not really mainstream. But also there's just a huge diversity. And so I love differences and diversity and having a lot of various things around to look at and work with. So there's 800 something different species of carnivorous plants, and then thousands upon thousands of hybrids that have been made in horticulture. I grow about 800-900 different varieties at this point. So I just get to play with all that variety and share them with people and so on.
Well, that's awesome. That's one thing that I've really loved about the animal world, is that there's all of these little different communities that you can be part of to kind of share your fascination or learn a little bit more. And that's at the heart of the Echo, that we try to share those stories and be part of those communities. And every time we talk to someone new, they're all like, oh, well, you should talk with this person. And then when we talk with them, they point us into a different direction. And so the community aspect is great. Are there any unique species of reptiles that are here in Colorado?
I don't think Colorado has any species that are actually just found here, sadly. But there's definitely plenty of interesting species that we have in this area that people probably aren't aware of. One of the coolest is we have western milk snakes that live in Colorado, and they live across a lot of the plains, and they will come up right into the Front Range. People will find them occasionally even within downtown Fort Collins and Denver. They're one of those brilliant tri-color black, white, and red snakes. So they really stand out when you find them, but they're fossorial, so they burrow. And they are only really on the surface for a very brief period in early spring, so people don't really encounter them very often. They go kind of unnoticed. And same goes with a lot of the other species that we have around. The plains black-headed snakes, you might find them along the Front Range as well. They're this tiny little worm-like species with a little black head. and they burrow and they eat small like centipedes and such. But you don't encounter them because, well, they're underground, so people don't know about them. Same actually kind of goes for carnivorous plants. We have 5 species that live in Colorado, but they're kind of rare, spotty distributions. So one, a lot of people just don't know what kind of carnivorous plants exist, so they don't know what a sundew or a bladderwort will be. And then two, because they're rare here, they're not going to come across them in the wild very often, so they won't really ask about them either.
That's brand new information for me. I'm definitely much more clued into the animal world. My knowledge with carnivorous plants, I think similarly, like you mentioned, I found some Venus fly traps a couple times, and I've tried to grow them, and I've also struck out a couple times. How about, are there any like really interesting species that live in the U.S. that you know about?
There's all sorts of cool species that live in the U.S., and you'll see some of them when I get the chance to go out and find them on the videos that I put on YouTube. We have multiple different kinds of king snakes that come in all sorts of different colors, and they're found all across the U.S. We have, of course, a lot of people are familiar with the bull and gopher snakes that are found in a lot of places, but they might not be aware of some of the endangered species that are found, like the black pine snake. I have one of them here as a pet and as an ambassador, but in the wild, they're only found in this tiny little area of Mississippi and Alabama. And right next door, Louisiana and Texas, they have the Louisiana pine snake, which is critically endangered. You have really colorful animals. The also endangered San Francisco garter snake, which is brilliantly colored in stripes of red and black and white and kind of teal blue across the belly, or some of its relatives, the California red spotted garter snake or the valley garter snakes, brilliantly colored animals. Any places where you have isolated mountain ranges, you'll have unique species or unique color forms that are found in them. So like in Arizona, you have all those sky islands, and every single one of those islands, they might have the same species of snake on each one, but each different mountain will have a differently colored population. A great example is the southwestern speckled rattlesnake. One mountain, you might have snakes that are your kind of average, like slaty grays and whites in their patterns. The next mountain, they might be more of this slate blue color. Next mountain might have peachy pink animals. Another one might have brilliant brown stripes on tan or pink backgrounds. Variety all over the place. For the carnivorous plant side of things, the U.S. has the American pitcher plant, Sarracenia, which are found throughout the Southeast. And then one species actually stretches up through New England and all across most of Canada. They're really cool. There's 11 species, but they can all hybridize with each other. So you can get these massive hybrid swarms and complex back crosses of plants that take on all sorts of different colors and patterns. We have a relative on the West Coast called the cobra lily, Darlingtonia. It's another pitcher plant, but it's got a structure that literally makes it look like each leaf is a cobra standing up with its hood out and a forked tongue all together. Strangest looking thing out there. And I'm really happy I've got at least one that's surviving okay in the Highland house that I've got here. Almost every single state will have species of aquatic or terrestrial bladderworts, which are some of the fastest moving plants on Earth. They're little traps. They look like bladders, hence the name. They will actually snap open and closed when they're triggered within a 2/1000th of a second. So faster than even most cameras can pick up. So even just here in the U.S., we have 50 plus species found all across the country. So a lot of variety. And again, most people don't encounter them on their average day, so they don't know they exist.
When you go out to look for reptiles, what kind of things do you bring with you? Do you have any tips that you might be able to give to listeners who want to get into going out and looking for animals?
Yeah, so the first thing that I will say is, one, always try to obey whatever local regulations and laws there are when it comes to looking for animals. Here in Colorado, I'm kind of lucky in order to go out and look for reptiles and amphibians, pick them up and so on. I don't really have to do anything special. We don't have too many regulations unless it's an endangered species like the boreal toad or so on. But other states, you might actually have in their regulations that you need a hunting or a fishing license to actually go out and pursue or catch some of these animals. So if you go to Arizona or to Oklahoma or Kansas, you're supposed to get either a fishing or a hunting license or a combo if you want to work with both reptiles and amphibians. When I go out, I will often be hiking in fairly remote areas. So always have your standard outdoor essential safety things, a first aid kit, means to contact people, or at least be able to stick around until somebody passes by. If something goes wrong, always have plenty of water and food on hand. I will take a 7-gallon jug with me if I'm going on a longer trip. And on that note as well, if I'm going on a longer trip, more than like an hour from my house, generally I will not go alone. I will take a friend or a family member or something with me, so that if one of us gets hurt somewhere, the other person can then usually drive to medical care if we need. So as a just in case, safety, 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 follow the regulations. And then when it comes to actually looking for the animals, it's mostly a process of experience. You have to learn what is going to make these animals most active, what time of year they're going to most likely be active, and kind of look into their natural history. Where do they naturally live? Where have other people generally located them? In the herping community, generally, it's frowned upon to give people exact sites and stuff to go see things, because while a lot of us are responsible and we just want to go out and take some photos, maybe hold the animal for briefly and then release it and so on, there are people out there who will scour social media and look for photos and locations and then go out and collect the animals to sell them or keep them themselves. And that's not always great for the species as a whole or just the local population, perhaps. Both you want to protect. So we will often say, if you go with someone who's experienced and they're willing to take you out to a place, great. Otherwise, it's often just learn the environment, try and figure out where the best places to go are kind of on your own, because we don't want to risk exposing these animals to people that we don't know their intentions. And another important thing is, if you're new to going out and looking for wildlife, hiking along trails is always good, just like a starter thing. Go out to an area that you think might be good, walk around, see if you can find stuff. If you go out a little more intensely and do things like flipping, picking up rocks or logs and cover, it's very important to only pick up things that you're fairly certain you can move back to where it was exactly, because you don't want to disturb the habitat any more than just picking up the rock does. So you want to put the rock or the log or the board or whatever back right where it was. And if you do find something under there, be it an interesting insect or a frog or a salamander or a snake, you want to move the animal out from under that cover before putting the cover back, because, and I have encountered this more than once this year with a beautiful milk snake, unfortunately, somebody picked up a rock, the snake was underneath, they put the rock right back down on it, and the snake was killed by that. So you want to make sure you are not going to harm the animal.
And I know, especially too, with flipping rocks and logs and things, another reason that it's so important is just because there isn't an animal underneath there right now doesn't mean that animals don't use that as a place of shelter. So making sure that you put it back so that they have that space to come back to. I like that you kind of touched on ethics a little bit. I just got an email that there's the reptile expos coming to Colorado. And so I know you have a couple different animal ambassadors at Wildfest. But I'm curious if you might be able to give some pros and cons of reptile, either the expos or the exotic animal trade. Because on one hand, you want to get people interested in reptiles. And there's certainly like pets that are great ways to start, like geckos and things like that. But I'm curious if you have any insight as to some things that the industry does well, maybe some things it does poorly.
There's always kind of a balance out there. A lot of people will be very hardcore against wild collected animals and so on, but they can be sometimes important for boosting bloodlines and genetic diversity or protecting a captive collection species that might be threatened in the wild and be at risk of poaching if we don't get like a captive population going. One thing that I will say is, if you're a beginner, you don't want to go pick up one from the wild yourself, and also don't buy wild collected animals from vendors at like the expos or online. You want to do your research, find somebody who has been captive breeding these animals, and they can give you information about like when the animal was born, how it's eating, show pictures of the parents and so on, so that you know the animal was produced in captivity. It's going to be more used to being in captivity, more used to being around people, and therefore going to be a lot better pet for you as well. But also working with that, you want to make sure that you're picking up an animal from somebody who is reputable and who is going to sell you animals that are going to be healthy, because there are a lot of vendors out there who will just sell whatever they produce at whatever rate they can get for the animals and not really bother looking at the quality of the animals that they're sending out, or flippers who will just go and buy bulk from somebody and then immediately turn around and just start selling them. So you want to make sure it's somebody who is making sure that animal is in good health first, that it's going to thrive for you before you take it home as a pet. It's partly just common sense, looking at the animals, looking at the breeder or vendor and so on, seeing how they interact with the animals and with the people around them. And oftentimes the best breeders will be ones who will kind of quiz you before they let you take the animal home. So have you looked up what this species actually requires? Do you already have a good setup for them, or are you capable of putting together this setup well before you take this animal home? Are you aware of how long the animal lives? Because that's a big one with reptiles and amphibians and stuff, is people look at a lot of them as like, oh, this is going to be a temporary, like a throwaway animal, and it won't be around very long, so we can get this as like practice for something else, when in reality, that corn snake, that garter snake, the little ball python that you just picked up, the leopard gecko, these are animals that will live 15, 20, 30, 40 years in captivity. So are you actually prepared to have that animal and care for that animal for 40 years in your collection? So
kind of the strength of the cold-blooded animals is they're kind of low energy, but as long as they're getting food, they can be incredibly long-lasting and, like you say, be around for a long time. Do you have a recommendation if someone wanted to step into the world of owning a snake, of a good species to kind of look for first? And then, like you said, make sure that they're doing their research on the best place to get it. Is there a good place to start?
It probably depends on what do you think you're actually capable of taking care of, since there's a lot of animals out there that maybe they require just a little bit more technical setup. But once that's set up, they're really easy to care for. Some of the species that I would say are great for beginners go with things like male Cape house snake or a sand or a rosy boa, because they stay relatively small and they're fairly easy to care for. A well-established gray banded king snake would also be a good option. Newly hatched babies, not so much, because they like to eat lizards and they can be kind of finicky. But once they're on mice and rats, they're really easy to care for. If you have a little bit more space, then I might suggest corn snakes or some of the other rat snakes, because they're really easy to take care of. One of the animals that I've heard is a really good pet, and I would love to get one of these days, are the Russian rat snakes. They need a fair bit of space because they're an animal that get to 6-8 feet long, but they're very placid. They're a cold temperate species, so they can tolerate a lot of variation in temperature, and they're fairly slow growing. So they're going to be around for a long time. They're docile, they're inquisitive, so they're good for an animal that you can work with and not have to worry about getting bit by or anything. And they're beautiful too, because the standard adult is jet black with like these yellow bands across it. Slightly more technical animals might be the ball pythons, or Dominican mountain boas are a really cool one too, because they look a lot like rainbow boas because they're related, but they can take a lot higher temperatures and lower humidity, and they will eat fairly regularly for you, and they generally don't bite most of the time. There's a variety out there, honestly, so it depends on what you want to work with, like what colors or patterns you're most interested in. But the biggest thing is, start researching the animal you're interested in, start getting a setup put together first, and then go and look for an animal.
Yeah, don't just go to a store or one of these expos and just grab a snake and then, oh, I'll figure it out. Now that I have the snake, I'll get everything else set up. Do your research first. You've given some really good education today on snakes and stuff like that. What is the best way to support you with Carlton Carnivores and the efforts that you do there?
I've got the website, carltoncarnivores.com, where you can find basically all the links that I have to all the other social media and sites and such. And on there, I will have my lists of the plants that I have for sale. All the orders I do, I handle manually when people send in contact or order forms. But everything that I have available is usually listed on there. I have a Patreon page, so patreon.com/hcarlton. If you don't want to buy plants per se, that's one way to support with monthly donations, so that I can keep making the videos and the blogs and such, building up finances so that I can expand, make better cages for the animals and better environments so I can let the plants grow out to their fullest potential and so on.
Awesome. Well, and we'll make sure to include links in the description of the podcast. But Håkan, thanks for expanding my knowledge on snakes and carnivorous plants and making sure that the listeners have a great foundation. Like we talked earlier, it starts from a place of education and then you can build your respect and appreciation from there. So yeah, it was a great episode.
Thanks for having me.
When I first met Håkan, it was at an animal education event, and he was very busy teaching lots of people about snakes, so I only got a brief moment to talk with him and ask some questions. To have him on the podcast and see him in his element, it was awesome. I just think he has a great balanced approach to educating about carnivorous snakes and reptiles while also selling carnivorous plants. If the mystery of today's What's That Animal has been bugging you with all this carnivore talk, I think I can remedy that now. But before I reveal the answer, let's listen one more time to the sound. This is the croaking of the North American spadefoot toad, which, like its name suggests, lives here in North America. These toads have an amazing ability when it comes to their tadpole stage. As a little bit of a biology reminder, frogs and toads generally lay eggs in water, and these hatch to emerge as tadpoles, essentially a head with a long tail. They then begin to slowly develop small legs. In this stage, they're called froglets or toadlets, sort of their teenage phase. And finally, their tail disappears, and now you have an adult frog or toad. These spadefoot toads live where water can often be scarce, in pools, ponds, or streams that appear after rainfall. These bodies of water may only last for a few weeks or even days. So the American spadefoot are prepared, and their eggs and their tadpoles develop extremely rapidly. The eggs can hatch within just a couple of days, and their tadpoles develop fully into adults in about 14 days. This is one of the fastest rates of metamorphosis observed by any amphibian. And that's pretty wild, if you ask me. One reason I love this segment is that I can share incredible animals with you and all the unique ways they can adapt to their environments. For more fun facts, stay tuned to the next episode for another chance to play
What's That Animal?
If you enjoyed this conversation, subscribe and consider supporting us directly at patreon.com/onewildpodcast. Here, you'll find exclusive content, like the full video versions of our conversations. To find out more about the other work we do, visit our website at onewildpodcast.com. Follow us on Instagram at @theechoanimals, and follow our TikTok at creature.feature. On behalf of all animals, thank you for listening.